Matthew 26, and we're going to start chipping away at verse 57 and move on from there, and I can't tell you exactly where we're going to end this morning. But again, we really are putting a lot more effort, I think, into these passages than we have in the past. We've studied all this stuff a number of times before, and I don't know about you, but as I go through it every time, I just find more and more and more challenges and more of those golden nuggets that God spreads all over His Word for us to find if we just take the time to look for them. Just remember the things that have taken place. The Garden of Gethsemane still, Jesus has been arrested. Peter's cut off the ear of one of the high priest's servants, and Jesus has kindly healed that. They've bound him up, and they're preparing to transport him away. Verse 57. Those who seized Jesus led him to Caiaphas, the high priest, where the scribes and the elders had gathered. Now, I know how much you know about high priests, sometimes referred to as chief priest, sometimes as a head priest. Sometimes it's a general rule or term that's kind of applied to anyone and everyone that was of a family of the high priest. But we understand this, that it's a gift. The position of high priest was a gift that God gave to Israel. Back in the days after he had brought them out of the land of Egypt, out of the land of bondage, and they had gone to Mount Sinai, and he had given them all kinds of instructions about things. And one of the things included in that were instructions in regard to the high priest. And we know that the high priest was to be the priest above all other priests. He had very special functions. His biggest part was to really oversee what all the other Levites and other priests did. But just a few specific responsibilities that he had. He was to do what we've just mentioned. He was also to actively inquire of the Lord, in other words, to pray continually. It was his responsibility to consecrate the other priests. In other words, when men from the Levitical tribe were brought into the office of priests, he had a big part in the ceremony, the consecration of them in that process. He also had the responsibility of making sure that the lampstand, the lights on the lampstand in the holy place never, ever went out. He burned incense daily on the altar of incense. He also was responsible for offering the sacrifices on the Day of Atonement. And as we speak of in the days of Jesus, he was also the head of the court called the Sanhedrin. That court was basically permitted by the Romans. They had some ability. They lacked some authority. They couldn't do everything. But in a sense, they were the ones who were responsible for governing the Jewish body under Roman rule. In this day, you have to understand that the power that they had was granted to them by Rome. In a sense. That we all know that God is the one who gives all power and all authority. And we know so God is the one who empowered them. Supposed to be a man of the greatest degree of piety and integrity and credibility. The man who loved the Lord his God with all of his heart and soul and mind, perhaps greater than anyone else in the whole nation of Israel. He was to live a life of integrity in regard to the duties of his office, in the public eye, in his personal life. We don't have any specific qualifications for that office, but we do have qualifications in the scriptures for elders. And we would be crazy to believe that a priest could serve without having these kinds of characteristics and qualifications ascribed to him. Above reproach, husband of one wife, intemperate, temperate, prudent, respectable, hospitable, able to teach, not addicted to wine, not pugnacious, gentle, peaceable, free from the love of money. One who managed his household well, not a new convert. And one who also had a good reputation with those outside the Jewish community. We don't get this from Matthew, but the Gospel of John actually tells us that before they take him to Caiaphas, they take him to another one of the high priests. His name was Annas. He was the father-in-law of Caiaphas. He had actually been deposed from the high priestly office by the Romans some years before that. But what we find in Annas and now what we're going to see in Caiaphas are not godly men at all. They see their position as a position of eliteness, as one that is has a purpose of gaining for them things that their dark hearts wish. For instance, we're going to realize this, that they were gathered at the house of Caiaphas, and it could easily be said that his house was not a house, his house was a palace. Let me ask you this, how many of you have a house large enough that you would have a courtyard in the middle of it where hundreds of people could probably gather together? You understand that money has always been a root of many evil things. And it's brought down a lot of people. Now, when you and I look out upon this land in leadership positions, just about at every level you can possibly imagine, what do you think we find? Men and women of great integrity, men and women who have a servant sense of leadership, who do what they do for your benefit. Or do you have more of an idea they do what they do for special interest groups who work to their special interest and to themselves? And I just bring this to your attention this morning because it just helps you and I to understand the degree of corruption that was present in the leadership of the nation of Israel in those days. Very much like what you and I see, perhaps even worse. We know that they hated Jesus and they were motivated by nothing other than jealousy and envy. I wonder if that hatred was not also pushed because they saw in Jesus the things they didn't see in themselves. In other words, when they looked in the mirror of Jesus and they compared themselves to him, they saw. But you know what, guys? Sometimes that picture humbles people. And see, that is what should have happened here. As Jesus comes before these men, if their hearts were right, if they were men of integrity, if they were truly seeking the heart of God, they would be broken to their knees before him. That we know this. We know the ugliness of the human heart. We know the degree of depravity that's there, the stranglehold that sin has on it. And in other people, guys, what this does is it stirs up hatred. And the more they see of him, the more they hate him. Jesus, my friends, perfect in every way, the perfect leader of people, the perfect servant leader The truth is this. Jesus shouldn't even been on trial here. Those men should have been. Every one of them. Because of their utter and absolute failure to do what their duties called for them to do. They were derelicts. They were supposed to be a blessing to the people, but I would imagine the average Jewish person walking on the street hated every one of them. The annals of Jewish prudence, there probably never has been such a travesty that's ever taken place in the history of mankind more shocking than this. What they were doing violated Jewish law on a number of points. And it just goes to show you that these were the law people. They could care less about the law unless it suited their purposes. In this case, it didn't. They were not allowed for a trial that carried the possible penalty of death to be conducted at night. Whammo, bammo, periodo. Like that word? No, there's a whole thing was totally against the law that they were supposed to uphold. No trial involving the possibility of the death sentence could be initiated on the eve of one of the festivals. Were they on the eve of a festival? The festival above festivals? Passover? You're going to find that Jesus will be ordered, commanded to incriminate himself. Also against Jewish law. He's also going to be condemned to death on the same night that he's tried. Jewish law says there has to be a day between the two. So, I mean, if we just could look at that and we consider just what we've talked about right there, we understand that these people could care less about God's law. And they are willing to do anything and everything to get rid of Jesus. They will violate every law there is to their evil end. This, my friends, was a kangaroo court. Matter of fact, I wouldn't be surprised if the whole idea of a kangaroo court is not rooted in what happens to Jesus here. Basically, a proceeding that leaps and bounds like a kangaroo through technical things that ignores the heart and the truth. And everything else. Peter was following him at a distance to the point of the courtyard of the high priest and came inside with the servants to see the end. Well, this is another place where John helps us to understand better what's going on here. And we do remember this, that we read just recently in verse 56, that when Jesus was arrested and they bound him and all that, that everybody left him and they fled. Let me tell you something. Somebody, an unbeliever, might be reading this, and they might say, well, look at this. They all fled and read, but then in just a verse or two, now we've got Peter following. Not only that, if you read John tells us Peter wasn't the only one following, that in essence he was too. Now, how do we deal with this? Well, we're going to deal with it in a little while, a little bit, but the big difference between these guys and Judas is this, is they fled, but they returned very soon. In other words, their fear overcame them for a short period of time, but it didn't last very long. You will notice, however, that Peter is following at a distance. Following at a distance. John also tells us this, that this other disciple was known by the high priest. And so he was able to walk immediately into the courtroom. On the other hand, Peter was not. But John went to the doorkeeper, and John was the one who enabled Peter to come into the court. Now, why there's a connection between him and the high priest, we don't know, but we know that this is God's word, and this is what John himself tells us. Right? We also know this, that Peter must in fact be there. He has to be there. He can't be somewhere else. Because Jesus has already told him he was going to deny him three times. That has to be fulfilled. It has to be so. And so it will be. Can you imagine being in there? Can you imagine the emotional things going through John and Peter as they've witnessed what took place in the Garden of Gethsemane, and now they're more privy to these things going on in this kangaroo court. So they bring Jesus in, and he's standing there before the Sanhedrin who's gathered there. But the high priest and the whole Sanhedrin sought false testimony against Jesus in order to put him to death. They sought false testimony. They were not looking at all for true testimony. What they were looking for specifically is what's described in the Greek as perjurers, perjury, people who would say untruths. And these were the people they were looking for. These were the people they wanted for witnesses. We're not really told that, but I would not be surprised if in some degree that there was some promises made to these people. The greasing of somebody's palm or something. To encourage them to get on the stand and do nothing but lie about Jesus. They don't care about truth. Truth is not part of the picture. The only thing they care about is their predetermined agenda and plan. And they're willing to do anything and everything to make it happen. I mean, can you imagine something like this taking place in any kind of a legal context? And when we're talking about legal stuff, what we're talking about here is people going out and finding witnesses who tell what they believe to be the truth. Not to sit on the stand and lie. Is that not a measure of the darkness of their hearts? You think about this. We're talking about here the King of Glory. And his judges are going to be Annas, Caiaphas, Pilate, and Herod. All of whom we know to be described as very wicked and evil people. Not men of integrity, but self-serving guys. You wonder why in the world they're even worried about any testimony at all. I mean, false testimony, why do you even bother to get testimony? Well, it's this, guys. They understand they can't go to the Romans with nothing in hand. They've got to go to the Romans with formal charges, and they have to have something to back up what they're saying. They need this testimony. And the roaches start coming out of the roach pile or the wood pile. But it's really kind of funny in the beginning, in a sense, because you have all these people telling lies, but they're not telling the same lies. Not even two of them tell the same thing. And just remember, according to Old Testament law, to convict someone, you had to have testimony in agreement between two or three or more witnesses. They found none that agreed, even though many false witnesses came forward. But finally, two came. So finally, two come saying the same thing. Now we have to understand, guys, that all of this, guys and gals, that all of this is going on is predetermined by God. You need to understand that. They think this is according to their predetermined plan. The reality is all according to God's predetermined plan, right? Every jot and tittle of everything that's unfolding here is an absolute necessity if you and I have salvation. In other words, if there's any inkling of anything that got left out that was supposed to be done according to God's plan, then we don't have a Savior. But it's with confidence that we come here this morning understanding that this all took place for our benefit, every bit of it. These two finally come, and this is what they say. They said, this one said, I'm able to tear down the temple of God and in 3 days rebuild it. Now, Jesus actually says something very similar to that. Remember the cleansing of the temple in John chapter 2? Occurs very early on in the Gospel of John. That's not what happened. That's not what Jesus said at all. What Jesus said was, Jesus was responding to a question asked by the Jews, and the question was this: what sign do you show us as your authority for doing these things? In other words, who gives you authority to overturn tables and run people out of the temple and all that other kind of thing? This is what Jesus said. He said, destroy this temple. In other words, you destroy this temple. You do it. You tear it down. And in 3 days, I'll raise it up again. That's a little bit different than what these guys are saying, right? And we understand this. We understand that Jesus is not talking about that stone temple. He's talking about his own body. That these men will kill him. They will destroy his temple. But they will not keep him in the grave. As hard as they try. And I would imagine they would have done anything they possibly could to keep that tomb sealed so he never saw the light of day again. But as hard as they try, they fail. They can't keep Jesus down. They'll put him down, but they can't keep him down. Do you ever think about this? There's a sense in which you can say that Jesus Christ died passively. In other words, he died for one reason. Because he allowed it. And because he chose not to defend himself. He passively took everything that Caiaphas and Pilate and everybody else throws at him. So there's a sense in which he died passively, but don't think for one minute that you can say the same thing about the resurrection. He resurrected himself actively. I lay down my life so that I may take it up again. No one has taken it away from me, but I lay it down on my own initiative. I have authority to lay it down, and I have authority to do what? To take it up again. So we must not ever think that these people had any power and authority over Jesus. Ever. They did what they did for one reason, and that is because he allowed it. The high priest stood and said to him, "Do you not answer what these are testifying against you?" Let me ask you something. You like to be slandered? Does it make you all comfy and cozy when you hear people are saying things about you that are not nice? What is your typical reaction? Well, how would you have reacted to what Caiaphas said to Jesus here? They said this, Jesus. Are you going to answer that? And he chooses not to. He remains silent. He doesn't say a word. See, if every one of us was there, what we would be doing is, the first thing we would do was correct them. Well, that's not what I said. This is what I said. I mean, no one likes to be slandered by other people. No one likes to have false things said about them. And the normal human reaction to those kinds of things is to strike back. We don't see this in our Lord Jesus at all. Have you ever tried that approach? Have you ever heard something or about you that people were saying or whatever, and you have willingly said, you know what? They're not right. What they're saying is wrong. But I don't even have to defend myself. Because God is my defender. You ever think about that? As a Christian, you really never have to defend yourself, ever. Because you have a heavenly Father who can defend you in ways you can't even imagine. But even so, and let me tell you something. These guys were put back because of the silence of Jesus. His unwillingness to defend himself. They didn't know what to do with it. And it ticked them off even more. Jesus is going to talk a number of times through the rest of this narrative. But what are you going to find in all of it? Out of all that he says, not one single time can you construe anything that he says as, in essence, defending himself. He never one time defends himself at all before any of these courts. Truth is, he sees the innocent one. From Isaiah 53:7, he was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth. Like a lamb that is led to slaughter and like a sheep that is silent before its shearers, so he did not open his mouth. I did some thinking about this week, and it doesn't make any sense to me to understand it in the way I think a lot of people do. Are we to think that the normal thing for a lamb that's going to be slaughtered is to lay there in quiet without trying to get away or bleeding or anything? Are we to believe that sheep, when you go to cut all the wool off with shears, which probably is a little painful, especially when they nick some skin, that they lay there passively just making themselves available to the people who are torturing them in a sense? Is that what's going on here? You've heard me say this before, that Jerusalem on the eve of the Passover was noted because there were hundreds of thousands of lambs in the city, and the bleating of the lambs was so loud it was deafening, especially at twilight when they were all slaughtered. Do you see, guys, what this is intended to do for us is to contrast what we expect and what we normally see to what reality is? Jesus stays silent. Let me tell you some things. Just try next time. Try this. Try saying, you know what? I'm not going to bother to defend myself. There's stuff I could probably say, but I'm not going to say a word. When you take that, it does either one of two things. It may anger somebody because they want you to defend yourself. But let me tell you, sometimes it takes the wind out of their sails because they flat don't know how to handle it, because it's not what they normally get. And maybe in that situation, they may say, this person must know something I just don't really know. Steve and our son. If you know him, you got to love him. Raising Steve had some challenges to it. First of all, he's left-handed, and I don't know if, and I'm right-handed, and Lori's right-handed, and everybody else in our family is right-handed, and it's really hard to teach, you know, if you're right-handed, to teach a left-hander how to do some things. Well, Sarah's left-handed. So she and Uncle Stephen are the lefties in the family. But I can remember one time when Stephen had done something pretty severe. And Lori and I were sitting at a table with him. And we were trying to get him just to confess to what he did. And he sat there and he didn't say anything. How do you think I reacted to that? It didn't give me warm and fuzzy feelings inside. The more he denied, the more I got angry. By the way, I was a pastor at that point. See, sometimes, guys, we don't think we're capable of certain things. We really don't. But God has a way of showing us. And sometimes it's very painful. Of showing us where we really are. I don't know why that even came to mind when I was thinking about this, but when I saw that, I'm thinking, you know, what made me any different in that circumstance or that situation than Caiaphas or Annas or any of these other people? And here I am, Stephen's father, who's supposed to be doing what's best for him and all that other stuff. Caiaphas gets angrier. He's incensed that Jesus will not respond. And in the name of the living God, he commands Jesus to answer the charge. In other words, God's standing in front of him. He's accusing God, and now he's calling on the name of God. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. And here is the tippy-toppy religious leader of Israel. They're going to charge Jesus with blasphemy, but you need to understand something. These guys are all committing blasphemy in what they do. The sad thing is this, is that by judging Jesus, the only thing they're doing is they are accumulating judgment points for themselves. In other words, they stand as the court. They stand as the judge of Jesus at this point, but there's coming a day when the tables are going to be turned and there's not going to be any shadow of a doubt who the real judge is. It's Jesus. Can you imagine? You guys ever read Dante's Divine Comedy? It's not funny, so. But it's supposedly this vision that he has of going through hell. And, you know, there's different degrees of hell. He enters into hell, and, you know, there's some bad stuff going on with some people, but he goes a little further, and things are worse. In other words, the torment, the torture is worse, goes further and further and further. And eventually he comes to where Judas is. He's at the last leg. This is the worst. This is the most severe judgment that falls upon anybody. And Judas is in the mouth of a great beast. And he chews him for the rest of eternity. We must remember there are a lot of things going on in the background here. And one of those is Satan. Is Satan in this picture? We haven't seen any reference to him or anything like that, but you and I would be crazy to believe that Satan's not right in the middle of this. Because remember, he was looking for that more opportune time, and guess what? He found it. Do you think it's possible for Satan to work through you? If you think not, you might want to rethink. Because when it comes to him, there's only one who stands between us. And that's Jesus. And let me tell you right now, if not for Jesus, you wouldn't stand a chance. Now, what do we do with all this? If we just continue with this, there's terrible, awful people who were dishonest and all that other kind of stuff. They're going to get what's coming to them, and I'll feel better about it then, and all that kind of stuff. Is that where we just leave all of this? Let me ask you, where do you think you would have been on that night? Would you have been there at all? Would you have been the only person at this point who stood up and said, I'm with Jesus and you can cut my head off right now and I'm fine with it? So where would you be? If not for God's grace, guys, you would have been right along there with Caiaphas and Annas and all these people. Hating Jesus so much that you just wanted him to be done with. Understand, guys, it's grace. I know you hear it all the time. Maybe I talk about grace too much. But it's grace alone that has made us children of God. Nothing we've done. If we were left to ourselves, we'd have been right in the crowd, rejoicing in this. But God has chosen a different path for Peter. And God chose a different path for John. He's chosen a different path for Larry and Grady and Avis and Dave. But it's all according to what? To his predetermined plan. Next week we will move on.